From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the fall of 2015 in a suburban high school classroom in Texas. Freshman Kobe Burin was reading the textbook in his geography class when he noticed a map. The map referred to Africans coming to American plantations as, quote, workers, not slaves. Kobe and his mother earned national headlines when they complained to the teacher, and eventually, the book's publisher, McGraw-Hill, promised to change the wording for future editions. But that leads to an interesting question. Who teaches the teachers? Who writes the books? Who leads the history discussion? In particular, who helps history teachers and social study teachers understand the material and make sure it's accurate and appropriate? This past Friday marked the 4th annual Teachers' Day at SUNY Geneseo, a program aimed at helping middle and high school teachers improve their grasp of history, their approach in the classroom. 50 teachers from 17 school districts participated, and yes, they reviewed areas covered by New York State Common Core curriculum as well. They also explored Native American history, a subject that is so often undercovered. The teachers participated in a workshop on medieval history. There was even a keynote on the Irish potato famine. We've asked some of the participants to come in and talk about teaching the teachers and Teachers' Day. My guests include Joe Cope, professor of history and director of SUNY Geneseo Center for Inquiry, Discovery, and Development. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Justin Barron is an associate professor and chair of the history department at SUNY Geneseo. Justin, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
And Sarah Prinzi is a 7th grade American history and AP psychology teacher at Geneseo Central School District and the biggest fan of Teachers' Day that I have found yet. Welcome to you, Sarah.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
That's fair, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, very fair.
We're going to be talking about why she gets so much value out of that. But Joe, a little bit of a background. This is the 4th time you've done it. How did this get going in the first place?
So, well, we had a history of reach out to teachers in the area. It's a really part of the culture of the history department at Geneseo. We were able 4 years ago, thanks to a generous gift from an alumni donor, to build this program, reach out to teachers at the secondary level, invite them to come back to Geneseo for a day of workshops and keynote lectures, and really just interacting and networking. Working with each other.
50 teachers a year, so you had 50 on Friday from 17 districts, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, and ultimately, if you could describe the mission in a sentence or two, how do you do it?
Well, you know, I think there are two things, really. The first is to make sure that the people who are engaged with the teaching of history are interacting with each other. There's a bridge between high school and college, and we want to make sure that we're having conversations about what's going on in the discipline. And then secondly, we also wanted to provide teachers with some tools, some resources that they could take back to their classrooms and really easily incorporate into their lessons, things like packets of reading materials, things of that nature.
Okay. Justin, you know, you're someone who has been on this program before, talking about your outstanding writing and the work that you've done, some of the scholarship you've done. How important is it to you to work with teachers on their approach, understanding how to have an accurate grasp? I mean, how do you view this kind of a day?
Well, it is integral to our mission at Geneseo as a public liberal arts college. You know, about a third of our majors go on into secondary education, and so this is something that we are dealing with on really semester by semester basis. It's also a way for us to connect with our alums and to see them, like Sarah, for instance, and to succeed and do well. And one of the things the teachers tell us why they find it so invigorating is because it reminds them of college and the things that they enjoyed about college, the learning and the engagement. And as an instructor myself, having students who are excited about learning gets me excited too. So it's a win-win for both of us.
And you're teaching on what subject?
I teach African-American history, yep. Civil War, and Reconstruction, mostly 19th century U.S. history.
All right, so when you've got one day and 50 teachers coming in, and you've got to talk to them about those subjects, there's a lot of different directions you could go. What do you choose to focus on?
Well, I choose to focus a bit on some of the things I see in my students that may need a little more emphasis at a lower level. So one of the things I've done in talking about Civil War history is to talk more about the importance of slavery as a foundational component of understanding the coming of the Civil War as well as its full development. A lot of my students, even here in New York, about two-thirds would say that the Civil War was started because of states' rights, and that just is not fit for
scholarship.
How
has this narrative, what has happened here?
I'm not exactly sure, although if you look at the New York State curriculum, it does talk about slavery and states' rights as kind of these dual causes of the war, and yet slavery is clearly the primary motivation, the cause. I mean, this is what the scholarship all says. I mean, the only reason why the states were looking for a right to do something different. It was a right to preserve slavery. So this is kind of this interesting cultural myth that is not necessarily unique to New York. It's widespread across this country. And in some ways, it's about not dealing with, I would argue, some of the historical traumas and wrongs of our past. And that again, gets back to one of the key points of an accurate historical education.
All right. So tell me if I'm wrong, and I don't mean to make an assumption, but my concern would be something like this. If you've got, and you gave a rough estimate, maybe even 2/3 of your students would tell you that the Civil War was about states' rights, not slavery. That's remarkable. And that's an indication that at some point in the lower levels, what they're being taught is that, or they may come from, it may come from confirmation biases of other kinds, but the bottom line is it's probably at least linked in some part to teaching. But are the types of teachers who go to Teacher's Day already the types who are teaching more accurately, or do you encounter teachers who say, well, you know, yes, that was our, I guess what I'm saying is it sort of an echo chamber, or are you breaking new ground here with them?
I think it's hard to say, I guess. You know, I haven't actually polled the teachers.
Yeah,
But, you know, I think they are eager to learn and to collaborate with us and to hear, in some ways, some of the new scholarship. And one of the things that we're seeing increasingly in Civil War era scholarship is the increasing role of looking at slavery as a national institution, looking at slavery integral to a world economy that's growing, that's developing industrial capacities. And more and more, those who are writing about the Civil War era are writing about the essential components of slavery. So this just reinforces in some ways what I can then bring to the teachers to kind of emphasize what is the way to kind of frame this story about not just the Civil War, but about America in general. And we're seeing this in a number of different avenues, from the role of the Ivy League schools and how they're connected to slavery, just to the way that the White House was built by slaves. There's more and more we're finally noticing in some ways the importance of slavery to our past and its legacies that are brought down into our present.
Yeah, I guess just expanding on something you hinted at earlier, and this may be an obvious one, but is it just that when the winners write the history and you have a self-awareness of what you've done, that history looks a little bit more exceptional with the way you tend to write it?
Yeah, well, this is the odd thing about the Civil War era is that the losers wrote the history. It was the Confederates, and the former Confederates were the ones that created this lost cause narrative that became so dominant roughly from the late 19th century to the mid to late 20th century. So now we're finally coming back to the winners.
That is interesting. But and then going beyond that, I mean, I guess that's what you choose. That's one thing you can choose to focus on. Do you get any more granular, or do you generally keep it on big topics on a day like that?
Oh, well, this is where we then connect to the primary sources. And the best way for me to make an argument about the centrality of slavery is to go look at what the Confederates said and what they did. And looking at their statements in support of secession, looking at the Confederate Constitution, looking at the policies of the Confederate government, because they were quite explicit that they were there to preserve white supremacy and slavery.
Well, let me turn to Sarah Prinze, again, a 7th grade American history and AP psychology teacher at Geneseo Central School District, who attended Teacher's Day on Friday at SUNY Geneseo. Mm-hmm. And you took a lot of notes, and you brought a lot of the notes with you.
I did.
Can you kind of take us through the day? Would you mind? I'd love
to
hear about it.
Sure. So usually in the morning, there are two sessions. I like to call them, I think workshops is a better fit, because it's not just lecture. It's also time to discuss and actually start looking at some of the primary source documents. And then there's the two workshops, and then there's lunch, and then there's the keynote address, which is our six things to everyone needs to know about whichever particular topic is chosen.
The Irish potato famine.
Or traditional East Asia was one,
okay, all right.
Native American history, mm-hmm. Civil War, of course. I think those are the four.
Okay. And as you took these notes, give me your sense as a teacher, you know, what your goal going into a day like that mm-hmm. is. You want to come out with what?
I want to come out, first I kind of want to bask in the research that someone else did and is now handing to me. I think as an undergraduate, I didn't appreciate that. I think it was, I was, as a student, when I was still taking my coursework, I was definitely sitting there thinking, okay, you know, I have to do all this. I got to learn as much as I can, but I also want to be a teacher. When can I be a teacher? Now that I'm a teacher and I'm responsible for teaching this information, I just want to suck in as much information as I can get because I want to make sure I'm teaching it right. As you mentioned earlier, so often teachers are overwhelmed with their responsibilities when they get in the classroom that I think sometimes it's really easy to just take the textbook at its word. And every single year I learn something at this workshop, multiple things at this workshop that are debunking myths or setting the record straight or bringing further anecdotes to make history more alive for the kids.
Can you think of any myths that were debunked?
Oh, yes. One of the ones that it almost felt like a little bit of an embarrassing slap in the face because I had taught it the week before was the myth of Quetzalcoatl, which I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's kind of a far-off thing.
What's the myth? Go ahead.
The myth is that the Native Americans believed that they had a legend that a white god was going to come across the Atlantic Ocean in a houseboat and rule them one day and bring peace. Well, it turns out, through more recent research, I found out, the myth of Quetzalcoatl was actually more likely the Native Americans being a little bit snarky. And again, as you said earlier, the people who wrote the history that we're reading are the explorers, and they read into the Native Americans supposedly, you know, being very accommodating as you must worship us, when actually what it was is maybe they were actually mocking the explorers, and that myth wasn't true.
And the way the history that you were taught and then subsequently taught yourself,
yes,
made the conquerors feel a little bit better about themselves.
It definitely
softened
did.
The edges of the history.
Yes, it did.
And you had taught that the week before?
Yes.
No, it's okay. This is fascinating. No, and I actually really admire you for talking about this.
Well,
so
thank you.
So then what do? Do you go back to class and say, look,
yep,
we got to revisit this?
Yep.
You did.
I said, oops, guess what, kids? I'm wrong. Remember that I told you last week? Just found out. Thank you, my former professors, for clearing that up for me. And the kids thought it was hilarious. And I probably remembered it even more because here's your teacher making a mistake and admitting it.
And, I hope admiring you for admitting it.
Aw.
And then grabbing that lesson, and you're right, probably.
You're making me blush a little
remembering
bit.
Remembering it even more. But does that worry you, though, as a teacher, that if you got the story of Quetzalcoatl wrong, what else is there that we are teaching the teachers about? What else is in the textbooks that is designed to make us feel a little bit better about ourselves, but maybe isn't historically accurate? Do you worry about that?
Oh, all the time. All the time. And to go back to talking about Civil War history, I'm maybe touching on it a little bit, but a little bit off is, the Haitian Rebellion. And that is something that was skipped over. That's my understanding is that's the only successful slave rebellion in history. Why don't we talk about that? Well, because Jefferson was president at the time. He didn't want us to talk about that. And so I feel like we're trying to kind of overcome that that suppression of that major historical event.
Wow. Okay. Justin, you want to weigh in on some of what you're hearing here, just kind of observing her reactions to this? I find it remarkable.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. But, it's worth pointing out this is what makes history rather dynamic. The past is not set in stone. It does change, and it changes in many ways by the concerns and the questions that we bring to it. And certainly the scholarship on the Haitian Revolution has been exploding in the last few years, and really seeing it in the way, in some ways, that people in the early 19th century saw it as this major event that everybody knew of and everybody was talking about. But because it was largely people of African descent that rose up in a rebellion and they established an independent republic and defeated British and French forces, there was no interest in the Americans or the Europeans to talk about this. They didn't want to talk about this defeat. But of course, all sorts of Native African Americans and other peoples were very conversant in this and saw this as inspiring. And taking it to the Civil War, the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, which is the first black regiment in the Civil War, one of their companies wore sashes that said the Toussaint Guards after Toussaint Louverture, who was the greatest leader of the Haitian Revolution.
Well, listeners, in some sense, I think I want to appeal to especially parents, but if you're a parent and you've ever had your kids come home and you're talking about their lessons or what they're learning and you went, what? This is the kind of thing where I'd love to hear. If Sarah Prinze can be as blunt and honest about what she learned and how she's applying that in a really admirable way, we'd love to hear from you. Do you have those kind of stories? It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Or maybe you think about what you were taught growing up, whether it's the cause of the Civil War or other big issues, if you look back now and say, wait a second, and Joe, I know, you know, Sarah kind of keeps wincing and I'm giving her a lot of credit, but I think that is a huge thing to hear a teacher say, 1 week ago we had this lesson and now I can teach it in a way that's much more contextualized. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that we try to really emphasize in professional history all the time. It's baked into our major, this notion that history is not about just reciting facts or memorizing dates, but rather it's about interpretation. It's about understanding that things that happened in the past are often contestable. They can be examined. They can be analyzed from different perspectives. And that's what we try to work with our students on. And we're really trying to bring that to the teachers as well during the Teacher's Day program.
I'd like to ask all of you, starting with Sarah, to, as a follow-up on the Quetzalcoatl story, which is part of a question I have that has to extend to other conversations going forward, which is, do you feel that we are underserving Native American history and authentic Native American history to begin with in this country, and how we can do that better? I mean, Sarah, how do you feel about that?
I wish Dr. Oberg was here. Yeah. He could give an amazing answer to that question.
And you know what? And she's talking about another of their colleagues at Geneseo, who mm-hmm. has been on this program in the past and will certainly be here again talking about this subject. But go ahead.
For sure. Professor Oberg was one of my professors at Geneseo, and he has spoken at Teacher Day. And there have been times where, as I'm teaching a lesson, I will try as best I can with the time I have to bring in the role Native Americans played in American history. You know, for example, causes of the War of 1812 was not just the British impressment of American sailors; it was also the British paying for Native American attacks on. Overland on American settlers. So, and then also in the American Revolution, you know, Native American attacks were a real threat. I think I'm quoting Dr. Goldberg verbatim right now. I think he said that last Friday. And also even in certain aspects of when it gets closer to the Civil War, I don't want to go on this, you know, too many specific anecdotes, but they really did play a role in making sure in every single era in American history that is addressed.
Okay. Well, Joe, what do you think on the subject of whether we're underserving, you know, on history when it comes to Native American history?
Well, I think if you look at a program like the history program at Geneseo, we've tried to really focus on global topics and to think about history as something beyond what you maybe would get in a textbook. I think, you know, Justin's career in emphasizing African-American history, which is one of the strengths in our department, Michael Oberg's work with Native American history, we're constantly trying to remind our students that there's more to the story than what we maybe get in the traditional narratives, and that we do want to make sure that the story that we tell about history is inclusive and includes as many voices and as much sort of balanced information as possible.
Okay, Justin?
And to add to that, you know, the best way to kind of understand our current problems, whether that's with the Dakota Pipeline or with Native American rights in New York, has to do with having a kind of a more integrative approach to this history and seeing Native American history as not just people of the past, but also people of the present. That there are still an awful lot of Native Americans in our communities that we're just not recognizing. And so one way to recognize them today is to recognize this ongoing conversant past that is integral through all eras of American history.
Yeah, it was a conversation about the Dakota Access Pipeline with Michael Galbin, a historian at Ganondagan, and I recently asked him, we had just recently had a conversation with a fourth grade teacher who's teaching redlining in Rochester. I thought, that is so interesting. Had this great conversation. And I asked Michael Galbin off air, I just said, you know, are there teachers, even individual teachers you can think of in our suburbs, our rural areas, the city schools, that is kind of going above and beyond teaching Native American history? And he said, you know, there's probably a few. And that's a conversation we'll revisit with Dr. Oberg, with Michael, with hopefully some individual teachers. But you're seeing how it starts to happen with Teachers Day, which is our conversation this hour. The fourth annual Teachers Day event took place this past Friday at SUNY Geneseo. They had 50 attendees from 17 school districts in the Genesee Valley, including Livingston, Monroe, Genesee, Steuben, and Wyoming County. And we're hearing from not only some of the professors, but also a participant, Sarah Prinzi. I want to grab a couple of your phone calls. Alice in Rochester. First up, go ahead, Alice.
Hi. A comment about history teaching and the history of it. My child a few years ago came home from seventh grade complaining that they'd been given a history handout from a teacher who said, now, just be a little careful of these handouts. They're 16 years old. The paper's getting a little fragile. It was about prehistory in the North and South American continents. And my child said, oh, you know, I think there's been some new information come out about this. And the teacher's response was, oh, heavens, this all happened 10,000 years ago. Nothing's changed since then. We both agreed that here was a teacher that really did need some further teaching about history.
Send them to Teacher's Day, Alice. There you go.
Yeah, there we go.
thanks for that, Alice. I have to believe that most teachers wouldn't have that reaction. I don't know. Sarah, what do you think? I mean, I would think most teachers would not have. I'm not questioning the story at all, but I would hope that most teachers wouldn't react that obstinately. What do you think?
I don't think they would, but I feel like I'm going to get in trouble if I answer that question.
You'd like to plead the fifth. Okay.
Yes, please.
Joe, I mean, I think teachers, for the most part, you know, teachers love learning, love education.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. And I think we need to understand that teachers right now are being pulled in a million different directions. Mm-hmm. They're operating in a context where they have all this standardized testing, all of these different forces pulling them in multiple different directions. One of the things I think we're hoping with Teachers Day is that we can give those teachers some really appropriate tools that they can then take back to the classroom to be as effective as possible within the context that they're currently working. And so we are giving them updated material, so you won't be pulling a 16-year-old handout from the packet that we provide the teachers with. And they'll be able to then integrate that into their classroom and maybe bring some really up-to-date scholarship on whatever topic it is that we've covered in the workshops back to their classroom.
Professor Barrett?
Yeah, just to add to that, one of the things we found with the teachers is that they really like our workshop because they have so few content options for professional development days. They're asked to learn other stuff, whether it relates to pedagogy, lesson planning, or adolescent psychology, what have you, testing regimens and so forth. But this is an opportunity to actually learn content. And we believe, and especially at Geneseo, that to be a good teacher, you have to really, a good social studies teacher, a good history teacher, you have to know the content. And that content will actually drive the history, will drive the passion in the classroom. And students will pick up on that as well. So that's another one of the impetus we have for this, is to inspire teachers so they can inspire students because they know the material and it's fresh and it's relevant to them.
All right, here's a question from Drew in Rochester on how we teach a big subject in schools. Go ahead, Drew.
Quickly, when is the narrative going to change on the Christopher Columbus exploration? He came over with criminals, he raped, pillaged, he did a lot of bad things. And would a teacher get in trouble if she told the full narrative of the Christopher Columbus voyage and of slavery, the violence of slavery?
Drew?
What would happen to a teacher if a teacher, I mean, if somebody complained, if one of the parents complained about the teacher telling a full story?
Drew, thank you for that. It's a very good question. Sarah Prinze, you want to start? Go ahead.
Thank you for asking that, Drew. I do actually teach that exact content area. And as long as the actual facts are appropriate for seventh graders, we are allowed to teach exactly what happened. And I honestly don't know any other seventh grade teachers who memorialize or make a hero out of what Christopher Columbus did. Too much damage came about, and you know, the research is it's there, and the information's there. And I know we still have Columbus Day off from school. I can't answer for that, but the kids, I don't think, want to give that one up. But in terms of the actual facts, as long as it is appropriate for 12-year-old ears, we're allowed to share it.
I think there is a movement afoot, and we're seeing it at least in a number of districts around the country. I don't know if we've seen it here, to change the name of Columbus Day to remember Native people and to memorialize that. But I think what I'm hearing from you, Sarah, is you don't get pushback from your administration. You're going to teach the history as we know it factually to be, and you haven't been told to kind of clean it up a little bit.
I have always been very supported by my administration. If I've got facts and research, I have experienced a lot of support.
But, Joe, Justin, I can imagine, I can remember growing up, and that was not the case. The Columbus picture was a bit of hagiography that I could recall growing up, Joe. I mean, so is this something that's changing, you think, across the country? Is this changing in more progressive districts? I mean, I don't know.
No, I think it is. I think it's changing across the country. And I think if you look at the way Columbus would be taught in a history classroom to people who are potentially going to go on to teach at the high school or middle school level, we're trying to talk about Columbus in complicated ways. Now, that doesn't mean that we say, okay, he's an unmitigated bad guy. But what we want to do is we want to think about, well, what are some of the complex issues involved with cultural exchange and first encounters, and how do those kinds of episodes get reflected in the case of Columbus? And I think it is trickling down. I know my daughter's in the Avon School District, and she had a student teacher that I taught 4 years ago this past semester, and she came home, and he prefaced it by saying, well, I learned this from your dad, and it was a Columbus a Columbus exercise. So it does seem to be trickling down. And again, I think like Sarah said, no evidence of pushback against a more complicated and subtle interpretation of controversial elements in history.
Yeah, and Justin, I wonder if you view this as a healthy change then, healthy evolution.
I think so. I mean, one of the things I've noticed in the past few years, and again with my own children in elementary, middle school now, is the emphasis, for instance, on Harriet Tubman. In ways that when I was going through elementary school, it just wasn't talked about as much. But I think that's a positive development. Here is an individual who ran away from slavery, who fought against slavery, participated in the Union Army, was a spy, and is a great example of heroism and fighting for freedom in ways that I think are very validating for us today. And so in some ways, it's about taking the typical narratives that we've heard before, but then also seeing how the heroes that we've had in the past, we might need to add some more to that. And Harriet Tubman, I think, is a great example of someone fighting from below, an ordinary person, not a president, not someone who's born into wealth, but expresses a lot of the values that I think we hold to this day.
Joe, you going to let me ask about the potato famine?
Absolutely.
All right, so let's get our only break of the hour. When we come back, we are going to throw, I'd say, a surprise, a bit of a twist. I mean, the Irish potato famine. We've been talking about how we teach the teachers. The fourth annual Teachers' Day event took place this past Friday at SUNY Geneseo with 50 teachers from 17 school districts in our region. That brings 200 teachers in 4 years that they have been working with. And you're hearing Sarah Prinzi, who's a 7th grade American history and AP psychology teacher at Geneseo Central School District. She was there. Joe Cope, professor of history and director of SUNY Geneseo Center for Inquiry, Discovery, and Development. And Justin Barron, associate professor and chair of the history department at SUNY Geneseo. So the potato famine, Common Core, even climate change, it's all ahead. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. We've been hearing for years that there's just no teaching jobs open, especially in the Northeast. But we're also hearing they can't get enough kids to go into teaching careers. What's the truth? And would you want your kids to go into teaching? There's an annual conference coming up attracting future educators. We'll talk about it. Then in our second hour, the very latest in heart health. Join us Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We'd love to hear from you as we continue our discussion on teaching the teachers and making sure history especially is taught accurately, with the latest in scholarly research and understanding. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Joe Cope, when he goes into the phone booth and changes and comes back out as a superhero, he's a British and Irish history teacher, and you did a potato famine thing.
That's right.
On Friday.
The keynote
it wasn't a thing. It was a keynote.
Right, yes.
I did not mean to demean that. I think it's fascinating and fun. So tell us about what you did.
Well, we had a tradition at Geneseo, beginning with Michael Oberg, who did a keynote 4 years ago, 6 Things Every New Yorker Should Know About the Iroquois But Are Seldom Taught. So we've picked up on that 6 things as the keynote theme. So this year, 6 Things Everyone Ought to Know About the Irish Potato Famine. And what I really tried to emphasize was that the Irish potato famine, you know, terrible tragedy in European history, also opens up doors for us to talk about other issues such as the difference between man-made and natural disasters, problems of structural inequality, the way that prejudices can influence interpretations of poverty and policymaking. So we talked both about the potato famine of the 1840s, but also some of the ways that connects to bigger themes in history.
Do you want to give me some of the points out of the 6?
Sure. Well, I kind of just did. The big one and the way I really want to start is by saying that when we talk about the famine, one of the things that we really need to be thinking about is the difference between natural and man-made disasters. There are natural elements in the famine. This is a fungal infection that spread really all over the Western Hemisphere in the 1840s. The reason that 2 million people disappeared in Ireland over the space of 7 years was because of man-made decisions about policy, decisions about what to do in the face of a natural disaster, or more specifically, what not to do in the face of a disaster.
What do we most often get wrong about the famine?
What do we most often get wrong? Well, what I try to push back a little bit against is a lot of students come to the classroom and they have a preconceived notion that when we talk about the famine, it can be easily told as a story of British bad guys and Irish good guys. And what I want to do is introduce more complexity into that and think about the ways that that very simple narrative doesn't really actually help us understand what happened in the 1840s very well.
Simple is easy, though, Joe.
Simple is easy. That's right. But historians, we're always trying to put complexity back
Absolutely.
Into the picture.
Absolutely. You can sense just why Sarah Prinzey was saying she gets so much out of a day like this. It makes us all, I would think, wish we could have been there. I want to grab another phone call. Jane in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan, I want to comment on this argument about states' rights or slavery. And I've always felt like, I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but that in the South there are many people who in their hearts they know slavery was wrong and that the South was wrong on that issue. That's very hard to live with for some people, I imagine. And I think their defense mechanism might be that they dress it up as, no, it wasn't about slavery. It was dying out anyway. It was about states' rights, and that puts it on a legal level, and you don't have to get into all the obscenities of slavery. You dodge that issue a little bit. That's always been my theory. But I always feel like somewhere that people must have realized that we're either going to have a democracy or we're going back to feudalism. Or we have feudalism. Some people have said that of the South, the feudalistic, very, very wealthy people. We're getting back to it, I think. But I think that may be part of it. And then I have a question for your guest. Mm-hmm. You remember we had the series Roots back in 77, and I knew people that were very bigoted who watched every episode of that, thought it was wonderful. But it didn't seem to really change their ideas. And I'm wondering what your guests think about that sort of thing where you bring it down to a micro level and show the day in and day out living as a slave and so forth or being enslaved. Do you have hope that that sort of thing might help people to give deeper thought to some of these type of issues that just they don't seem to go away? Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Justin, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jane, for the question. I think one of the question you asked about roots really gets at the importance of empathy, and I think empathy is central to history and a good history education. It's really important to understand what it was like to be enslaved, what it was like to live at that time, and what it was like to be a slave owner as well. This is the type of complexity that I think we're searching for here. Of course, slavery was wrong. It was horrible. It was this foundational sin, as Abraham Lincoln referred to. But if we're just blaming one side or the other, that won't lead to a broader understanding of it. So we have to kind of push back against that and really kind of reckon with the implications of that. I think the implications of slavery are difficult for us to talk about, and that alludes to what Jane was talking about in the first part of her comments. But avoiding that issue, I don't think is helpful either. We have a legacy of racial discrimination, of inequalities that don't match up to the country's ideals. And students recognize that, and students are looking for an explanation of why this is the case. And I think this is where history educators, social studies teachers have an important role in helping students understand the world that they've inherited, all the good things that they've inherited in America, but also there's a darker side to that, and the racism and the inequalities that are all around us, and we need to wrestle with that. And I think that's our obligation as citizens to do so.
Sarah, do you hear kids articulating questions or comments about that?
Yes. In fact, and I also want to tie this back to History Teacher Day and how important that is that we have these documents and we have professors who are doing this research and providing the information so that we can take a stand, because the implications are huge. You know, where do we go from here? How do we approach these still existing racial controversies and tensions in our history that affect our day-to-day lives? And it can be very difficult to know how to navigate what sometimes feels like a landmine with this particular topic. I have had students in class who feel that the Civil War was based on states' rights. And I have had students in class who believe the Civil War was based on slavery. And how is it that I can teach the Civil War accurately and yet not get myself in trouble? You know, and I think having the primary sources from History Teacher Day gives me a leg to stand on. And I can say, here's the information. Yep, here's the, you know, yes, it may sound like I'm coming to this conclusion. But here's the information, and in some respects, I can say to the kids now, use those higher level thinking skills and decide for yourselves using this information.
Sure, and it's one thing if you've got a kid who's 11 or 12 saying, "No, Ms. Prinzi, I'm pretty sure it was states' rights," and you're going, "I do the teaching here." But it's another if you get a phone call from a parent who says, mm-hmm. "Hey, why is this lesson teaching this?" You feel more empowered to give a good scholarly answer, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
Really good stuff. Before we grab some phone calls, anything you want to add there, Joe?
No, I think, that's exactly right. I think, and again, bringing complexity back into the story, that's what historians do. That's really integral to everything that we try to emphasize in Teacher's Day.
All right. Gary in Bloomfield, next up on the phones. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, I was referring to making a comment about sources of information. Way back, I got to say, back in the 80s, there was a book that I remember reading called Lies My Teachers Told Me. And it's a bunch of vignettes of different conflicting ways history was presented. And basically, a lot of history in my generation, I'm considerably older, but was taught more from the perspective of preserving the American myth than it was in preserving factuality or seeing it in any kind of perspective or different perspectives. But I remember using this book. I've written skits and stuff based on the information, and various churches that I've participated in, you know, I've had their youth groups perform them, and the people are really, it's a great way of promoting discussion.
Gary, hello? Thanks. That's not a lot of nods around the table. I had not heard that book. Is that popular?
I read that book, actually, right before I started teaching, about 13 years ago. The book did come out a while ago. And I remember thinking, wow, I remember my history professors told me. And about way more than, there's almost no surprises in the book. That is a little bit of a shout out to the SUNY Geneseo History Department.
She's so good. No, seriously, could there be a better teacher that you guys could have brought than Sarah, who has more of an appreciation for what you do? I think that's great. And you probably also thought, I would like to not be quoted in a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me in the future.
Definitely.
Justin?
Yeah, it's a book that actually looks at textbooks, particularly from the 80s and 90s. But it also gets to a larger issue in the sense of textbooks are trying to cover so many different constituencies. And I think the story, the narrative thread kind of gets lost in there as the political pressure that's put on history education. And this is, again, why we think it's so important to actually go back to the sources, go back to the documents, and use that as a primary tool to go ahead and bring that history to the students. And when you do it that way, it's not only more engaging, but it's also more accurate.
All right, I want to grab William in Rochester, who wants to weigh in on states' rights and slavery. Go ahead, William.
Yes, two comments I have. First of all, I'm a black man and grew up in this city, and I do believe that it was both the states' rights argument as well as slaves that fueled the civil rights. Now, from an adversarial position, the states argued that they had the right to own slaves and that the federal government did not have the right to interfere with that. So it seems almost like it's semantical to argue which one should be taught, because they both are valid arguments. States were arguing, we have the right. Fed saying, no, you don't. Now, the other comment I have is, I read someplace in college, and please don't ask me where, it's been so many years I don't remember, but I remember that the reading that the Lincoln administration wasn't going to interfere with the southern states if they agreed not to expand slavery out west. The southern states wanted to go out to Kansas and Texas with slavery. And I read that Lincoln said, as long as you keep it right where it is, we won't trouble you with it. And like I said, I don't remember where I read it.
Well, hold on, William. Can you stay there for 1 second?
Yes, I can.
I just have a quick question for you, and then I'll turn it over to Justin Barron, who I think is going to be our authority on this. But
okay.
So when you think about states' rights and slavery, look at an issue like the federal minimum wage. There are state leaders who think that there should be no federal minimum wage, that living in New York is different than living in Oklahoma versus living in Texas, and that why should we have to have at least a floor minimum wage from the federal government? Shouldn't we be able to make those rules? I don't think they'd go to war over it, though. I think the issue on slavery was, sure, we can dress it up in states' rights, and we do want that right to say, yes, slavery is legal here, and we will go to war over it. We will secede over it. I think for me, as someone who's just trying to follow a correct course of history, there's a difference between saying, yeah, it was about states' rights, they didn't like this, but would they have gone to war over anything but slavery? Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense in terms of the economic benefits that the South was getting. They were getting rich, and they didn't want to let go of it. And they were saying to the states, just as you argue about minimum wage, there are companies that saying, no, if we raise the minimum wage, it's going to cut into our bottom line. Is it a big enough issue to go to war? Probably not. But the monetary benefits of the South was big enough for them to say, yeah, we'll fight over this because we're making bundles of money and we don't want to lose it.
Well, William, I want to thank you for the phone call, and I will now turn it over to Professor Barron. What do you think?
Well, it wasn't just the economic benefits. Only about a quarter of white Southerners actually owned slaves, so they had to convince the majority of the white population to go to war. And the way you did that was through white supremacy, to say that slavery is a system that will keep white people on top, and you can never be on the bottom because there will only be slaves. So that was integral in mobilizing the vast majority of the Southern white Southern society. In regards to states' rights, it's important to point out, I think, that states' rights is a convenient argument at that at the time when after the Democrats in the South had lost the 1860 election. Prior to that, they were all in favor of federal rights. They wanted more federal power to protect slavery. They liked the Dred Scott decision of 1857. They liked the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. They had no problem at all if federal power was used to protect slavery. It was only when they lost control of federal government that the states' rights arguments really became ramped up.
Okay. And have you heard comments like Williams before, sort of questioning, or at least saying, hey, part and parcel, states' rights,
right,
slavery.
Right. But again, it's what's the right that those states wanted? We can even pull that back a bit and talk about what is the South. And we talk about the South seceding. Well, the South is only the South, not just because of geography, it's because it's those states that actually legalize slavery. And so embedded in the notion of the South is an endorsement of slavery. And so when the South, and not every Southern state seceded, four did not, but the majority of the Southern states seceded, it's to protect slavery. And again, going back to the documents that those who argued for secession, they said it was twin. It was to protect slavery and to protect white superiority. Alexander H. Stephens, who's the vice president of the Confederacy, said that the Founding Fathers got it wrong. The Founding Fathers said that all men are created equal and that the Confederacy was there to correct it and to say that all men are not created equal.
Hmm. All right, I'm starting to run out of the hour, and there's a few other things I want to hit here. And, Sarah Prinze, who is a 7th grade American history and AP psychology teacher in the Geneseo Central School District, you know, related to some of the points you've made about students and how they're learning and learning accurate material, you know, should students be learning how to think critically and not be afraid to question information that might seem inaccurate to them? I mean, should it be part of a teacher's responsibility to help students learn how to reason and learn how to evaluate this? And that gets tricky because then all of a sudden that student might think, well, do I trust it? I mean, you want, for the most part, you want kids trusting their teachers, right? But while still having a door open to say, this might be uncomfortable. I mean, how do you strike that balance?
One thing is what I mentioned earlier is admitting when I'm wrong. I have had kids bring things up in class before that I hadn't realized. And teaching controversial topics while also encouraging the kids to think critically it's a difficult dance. But it's one of my favorite parts of my job because it makes no day ever the same. And it's always learning. It never goes stale because I've had students in my class while I'm teaching the Civil War who have said straight up, I'm from Alabama and I don't agree with you Northerners and my mom told me the South will rise again. Okay, so where do we go from there? You know, and how do I open this conversation in class in a way that I still teach the content in a way that is accurate, it's always hard to be objective because we're human, but in the same way, you know, allows students of different perspectives to feel heard because I can't shut someone down because I disagree with them.
Professor Barron, if you had a student who said, look, I'm from the South and my parents said the South will rise again and that, you know, we've got certain things wrong here, how would you handle it?
Well, I would go back to not just the documents, but the historical profession that has said for the last 50 years that slavery is the main cause of the Civil War. I mean, it's really a popular conception that brings up the states' rights, not the profession itself.
Tough one. And Common Core was on the list of things that I think we're going to get discussed. And, you know, we don't have to go too deep on this, but I am curious to know if there is any concern that Common Core is constraining. I just want to read a critique from National Review Online, and then we'll let you guys kind of talk about what you might have talked about on Teacher's Day on Friday. This is from National Review just this past weekend. Quote, Common Core might make some students more ready for vocational training, but it will make most less ready for the kind of work we used to associate with college. One problem with Common Core is that its standards call for a 70-30 division between informational texts and literature in reading throughout K-12. The problem is that reading of complex material does more to prepare students for what they should read and write about in college than informational material. So Common Core means that students will read fewer pages of Dickens and Dostoevsky and more pages devoted to such informational material as federal administrative orders. End quote. That's from National Review Online. Sarah Prinze, some thoughts on Common Core and how it might impact or not impact you.
Sure. I, as well as other teachers, have communicated that we really feel that history and social studies, we sort of lucked out in a way because some of the ways that the pushes for the Common Core are reading from an informational text. Well, we've been doing that from the beginning. That's what a DBQ, a document-based question essay, is, and that's been part of the Regents exams for years. The push to think critically, again, that's something that using documents in your analysis, finding evidence from the text, those are all things that we've been doing for decades in the social studies classroom. Some of the ways the Common Core has changed for, in particular, New York State, we have a framework that came down that actually focuses more on concepts than bulleted bits of information we need to have the students memorize, which I find a lot more freeing. I'm sure not every teacher would agree with me on this, but the new Regents exams that are going to be coming out in the next couple of years, again, focusing a lot on using information from informational texts, and you've got multiple choice questions based on documents. You've got short answers that are going to be based on documents, and not a ton of change from what I've seen so far.
Okay.
And still very linear.
Okay. So not all that constraining for you then in what you're doing in the classroom.
Yes, I think so.
Okay. Joe?
Yeah, I think to pick up on something that Sarah just said, I think the focus on documents and interpretation of evidence is actually something that is good for college-level history. This is what we really do try to focus on in teaching history. Always go back to the documents. That goes back to Thucydides in the 5th century BCE. Go look at the original historical evidence. And as historians, I think we have tools and we have approaches to texts to interrogate those texts, to try to get behind the texts, to figure out how they fit into context and how to assemble those texts into an argument or analysis. And so I think the fact that high school students are being encouraged to go look at historical evidence is actually a good thing. I think it's very good for our understanding of the past.
All right, Professor Barron, some final thoughts from you on that.
Yeah, I agree. The only concern that I would have is that they're still being the teachers are still asked to give an awful lot of coverage. They still want the coverage of all U.S. history or all world history, as well as the depth of primary source documents and context. And that's something we don't do in college. We separate that out. We've got lower level surveys that do coverage, and then upper level seminars that go in depth, because it really is a bit constraining. So that's one of the concerns I have going forward. If the state would pull back from some of the coverage, emphasize more of the depth, I think that'd be more in line with what we would like to see.
All right, we got a split, but Joe Cope, if you know a teacher who would love to be a part of Teacher's Day next year, I assume you're going to do it next
year. That's right.
Yep. How do they get involved?
They could contact the history department. Our information is all on our website.
SUNY Geneseo.
That's right. History.geneseo.edu. I'm the contact person, so they can reach out to me directly.
That's great. Congratulations on year 4, and thank you so much for being here. That's Joe Cope, Professor of History and Director of SUNY Geneseo's Center for Inquiry, Discovery, and Development. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Justin Barron, Associate Professor and Chair of the History Department at SUNY Geneseo. Always good to have you. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you so much.
And Sarah Prinze, I hope my kid has a teacher like you someday. 7th grade American history and AP psychology teacher at Geneseo Central School District. Great having you here. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we will talk to you on a snowy Tuesday on member-supported public radio.